Well, a few of you were asking me how my time was in Edmonton last Sunday. I actually spent 3 days in Edmonton. And it was in the low 50s, but I guess they've had a long, hard winter because when they introduced me, they said, "Isn't it wonderful that we finally have a day where we can go outside?" So, second week of June, I don't know. That sounds like a harsh winter to me. So, but it was great, and it's a church that's highly innovative in the sense that they now have four campuses all over the greater Edmonton area and are thinking about expanding to more. So I was speaking at one campus, but actually was being broadcast into all these other campuses as well. Highly visual. I mean, across the front they had 9 big screens, and then they had screens all the way around. And their whole point is that Canadians are visual, and so we have to give them something to look at all the time. And and they said, you know, we kind of looked at what you're going to speak about, so we've collected some nature images to go with this. And I found out they're actually going to show them throughout the entire service. And then they saw my screensaver, and they said, "Can we use your screensaver?" So because they were quite thrilled to see I had all these photos of Canadian mountains. So I actually had the entire service, at least my photos did, and then the rest of the message. But I think what encouraged me most is this is a church that's making a major push to what they call mid-sized groups. And, you know, a lot of churches, they have the big congregation. In fact, the congregation I was speaking to, I would guess there were 1,800 to 2,000 people in the sanctuary. And then there was the other campuses as well. And then they have all these small groups, which are like 8 to 10 people. But the thing they're really stressing, what they call mid-sized groups, which they define as between 20 and 60 people. And the principle there is, if you go to a mid-sized group, the probability that someone will put you on the spot and make you feel embarrassed, they said, is less than 5%. The group's too big. But the probability of you having a meaningful conversation with someone, they said, is about 95%. There's enough people there that it's a small enough group that there will be meaningful engagement. And they said the probability you're going to hear something you've never heard before, 100%. And that, I think, is what describes this group here. We're a mid-sized group. And one reason I commit myself to this is for those very principles. If people can come here and they just want to hide and listen, they can do that. If they want to get involved, they can do that. And it's small enough and personable enough that people can have meaningful conversations. And you know that I strive to make sure that every time I come here, I present something that is going to be new, at least to the majority of you, if not all of you. In fact, I've come here today prepared with an incredible new scientific discovery, but I'm going to do something different. We've been struggling to get through this first part of Psalm 147 and 148, where the text talks about the stars and how God created the stars for our benefit. Every star we need in order for us human beings to exist here on the earth, and God literally knows the name of every star by name. And, you know, we talked about how there are 50 billion trillion stars, approximately, in the entire observable universe. And the universe that we actually live in, keeping in mind that the universe we see through the telescope is not as big as the universe that exists today, because after all, the universe we see through the telescope is the universe of the past, not the universe of the present. And hey, we live in an expanding universe. And so the actual universe is several hundred times bigger than the universe that we see. So take those 50 billion trillion stars and multiply it up a little bit. And you know, what we're going to be talking about is the mass of the universe. And we now know that these stars make up 1% of the total mass of the universe. And you know, traditionally people thought the stars made up nearly all the mass of the universe. We now know that the universe is predominantly made up of dark stuff. And I'm not just talking dark energy, just the dark matter alone is about 99% of all the matter that exists in the universe. And the matter makes up about 30% of all the stuff of the universe. 70% is dark energy, the energy that's embedded in the space surface of the universe. 30% of it is made up of matter. But of that 30%, only 1% is actually stars and planets and moons. The rest of it is small bits and pieces of ordinary matter, so tiny that it doesn't emit any light. But keep in mind, for every particle of ordinary matter, we've got five or six times as much exotic matter. You say, what's the difference? Ordinary matter is stuff that we're made up of, protons, neutrons, and electrons, which has a property that it strongly interacts with light. And exotic matter is made up of exotic particles. We're still trying to discover some of those particles. We know that neutrinos falls in that category. And we're on the verge of discovering axions. But these are particles of matter that do not strongly interact with light. So, for example, an axion or a neutrino can pass right through the Earth without interacting with anything. Neutrinos will weakly interact, so if you build the right kind of detector, you might be lucky enough to see a neutrino interacting with photons in ordinary matter, but it's very rare, unlike protons, neutrons, and electrons. So today we've got a good measure of just how massive the universe is, and if you were here in weeks before, we kind of looked at the mass that's built up in stars, how our star, the Sun, is about 1,300,000 times bigger than the Earth. Not quite that many times more massive, but hundreds of thousands of times more massive than the Earth. And then you multiply that by 50 billion trillion, multiply that by 100, then multiply that by a few hundred, and you've got a pretty good idea of the mass of the universe. But today we understand that this universe, as massive as it is, every bit of it is needed to have a planet like Earth. If we had fewer stars, less mass in the universe, then we would be in trouble. And we briefly introduced this 2 weeks ago when I was here, making the point that the mass of the universe does two things to make possible planet Earth. The first thing is that the mass of the universe determines what your periodic table is going to look like. If you look at the periodic table, there are 92 naturally existing elements. And hey, when God first formed the Earth, we actually had 94 naturally occurring elements. Two of them have decayed away, but 92. But what wasn't fully appreciated until recently is just how extraordinarily difficult it is to have a universe where you get 92 elements in the periodic table. And hey, if you want to have the technology we enjoy here on the Earth, you really do need all 92 of those elements. And incidentally, just to have your body be able to do the things that it does, you need 22 of the elements in the periodic table. And what astronomers and physicists have discovered is that the total mass of the universe determines what kind of elements are going to flesh out the periodic table. And it's because in the early history of the universe, there's a fusion event that takes place. So nuclear fusion not only occurs in stars, it also occurs in the universe as a whole when it is extremely young. Why? Because we have this expanding universe, where the universe expands from a space-time singularity. And we just saw the verse here a little bit earlier in Romans 8, how the entire creation is subject to the law of decay, a reference to the second law of thermodynamics. And because of that second law of thermodynamics, any system that expands gets colder. Well, we can trace the history of the universe back in time when the universe was smaller and smaller in size, and what we discover is that in the past it was hotter than it is today. In fact, astronomers have the capability of measuring the past temperature of the universe. I should have brought the chart here with me. I've got it elsewhere in my computer. I'm not going to take the time to try to dig it out. That might take me too long. But astronomers have been looking at gas clouds in distant galaxies and quasars and literally measuring the past temperature of the universe. The current temperature, 2.725 degrees above absolute zero. That's the temperature of the cosmic background radiation. But we can look at these distant galaxies and quasars and measure the temperature of that radiation at different look-back times. And so if you go far enough back in time, we see it's about 10 degrees. I think 12 degrees is the hottest we've been able to measure. And that's when you're looking at the universe when it's about a half billion years old. But it is such that we can take these 13 measurements of the past temperature of the universe and recognize that it confirms that the temperature of the universe literally would have been extremely hot near the cosmic creation event, literally quadrillions of degrees and hotter. And that likewise we can determine from those measurements when the universe went through the temperature window where nuclear fusion can take place. So for example, inside stars, stars can fuse hydrogen into helium and helium into heavier elements in the temperature window. 17 billion degrees is the minimum. It's got to be at least that warm. But if it gets warmer than about 200 billion degrees, then it won't work. So that's the window. About 200 billion degrees to 17 billion degrees is the window when you can expect fusion to take place. And so what astronomers have done is to take the Big Bang creation model and take these actual measurements of the past temperature of the universe at different look-back times in the history of the universe and determine when the universe passed through that window where fusion can take place. And the answer is it happens when the universe is between 3 and 3.5 minutes old. 3 to 3.5 minutes after the cosmic creation event, the temperature of the universe is in that fusion window. Now, here's where the mass of the universe is crucial. If the universe has more mass than what we measure, then the universe is going to spend more time in that temperature window. And if it's less massive, it'll spend less time. So the mass of the universe determines how quickly or slowly the universe passes through that fusion window. So yeah, as massive as the universe is, 50 billion trillion stars times 100 times several hundred to get the actual universe. If you make the mass a little bit less, then the universe spends less time going through that nuclear fusion window. Make it a little bit more, it spends more time. And here's the situation. If you take the total mass of the universe and bring it down ever so slightly, then the universe will spend so little time in the fusion window that you're only going to get a few percent of the hydrogen. So the universe starts off with the one element hydrogen. And what happened in the universe in which we live is during that window between 3 and 3.5 minutes, about one quarter of all the hydrogen was fused into helium. And then there's very tiny amounts of lithium and beryllium and boron, very tiny amounts. About one quarter of the hydrogen was fused into helium. And so that mixture of 75% hydrogen and 25% helium is what stars start off with. And then when stars go through their fusion window, our star, the Sun, spends 9 billion years in its fusion window. But what it is taking is that mixture of hydrogen and helium, and then on that basis, it's making other elements. And it's that ratio of hydrogen to helium determines whether or not the future stars will make what kinds of elements. So, for example, if we start off with stars where you only got 20% helium instead of 24% helium or 25% helium, those stars will burn in such a way that all they're going to do is make additional helium. So you wind up with a universe that has no elements heavier than helium, which means you're going to have a universe with no carbon, no oxygen, no nitrogen, no phosphorus, and no possibility for life chemistry. Now, if you go the other way and increase the helium abundance a little bit above that 24% level, then what happens is that when the stars form, they very efficiently fuse their hydrogen-helium mixture into nothing but elements that are heavier than iron. And so you wind up with a universe that has all the elements in the periodic table, like iron and those above iron, but nothing less than iron. Which means, again, you're going to have a universe with no carbon, no oxygen, no nitrogen, no phosphorus, no magnesium. You know, all those little pills you take in the morning, they won't exist, and therefore no possibility for life. And so what astronomers have determined is, well, just how fine-tuned do we need to make the universe so that we get all the elements we need to make advanced life possible? And it turns out just to get carbon, oxygen, and nitrogen existing in the quantities that make life feasible, even that requires extraordinary fine-tuning. But to get the 22 elements that would make possible advanced life, the fine-tuning is orders of magnitude more severe again. And so literally it's such that if you were to take all the stars of the universe and change the mass by adding a few stars or subtracting a few stars, you're not going to wind up with the mix of elements that we see in the periodic table that would make life possible. Now, keep in mind, when you look at planet Earth, we have a periodic table like no other body in the universe. You'll see some articles that we've written on the reasons.org website where you can literally take every element that you see in the periodic table with the exception of hydrogen and helium, and every one of them has an anomalous abundance in terms of what we would expect on Earth-like planets elsewhere in the universe. One thing you'll see in our website is what I've done is to take the ratio of the elements we see in the crust of the Earth relative to magnesium. I got another one relative to iron. And I picked iron and magnesium because they're ubiquitous throughout the universe, and everywhere you see about the same abundance of magnesium and iron. And Earth has fairly close to that abundance of iron and magnesium, not exactly right on, but of all the elements in the periodic table, we're most normal when it comes to magnesium and iron. That's where we have the greatest normalcy relative to what we expect for rocky bodies elsewhere in the universe. But then what we do is we compare the ratio of all the rest of the elements to magnesium and iron. And every one of them is extremely anomalous. To give you some idea, we have 40 times as much titanium. We have 60 times as much aluminum. We have 60 times less sulfur. As you look at all the elements, the anomalous abundance that we see here on the Earth is exactly what you need to make advanced life possible. So, you know, one reason why we're recognizing that Mars is not a candidate for life, or not a candidate even for us to go there and try to colonize it, is that their periodic table is so far different from ours, it would be extremely challenging for us to go to Mars and try to make a living there. We just don't have the stuff there on Mars that we have here on the Earth, and it's a highly toxic environment. And where we're most anomalous, by the way, is, and this is the great challenge, is that when it comes to uranium and thorium, we're extremely anomalous. You say, how anomalous? Well, with uranium, we have 600 times more. With thorium, we have 360 times more. And so if you look at what we see here on the Earth, this is where we have the greatest anomaly of all the elements in the periodic table. But it's because of that huge abundance of uranium and thorium that we have continents and oceans on our surface. And we have a strong, stable magnetic field. And you say, what causes the continents? It's uranium and thorium in the interior of the Earth and in the crust of the Earth. What makes our stable magnetic field possible? It's the uranium and thorium, the heat released from that uranium and thorium. And if you read our articles, you'll recognize that there were three major events in the history of our solar system that super enriched our planet Earth. There was the birthing cluster in which our solar system was born. We were born in a very dense cluster of stars and had the good fortune of having our planet form right next to a sequence of stars that went through supernova eruptions. And by the way, you need more than one because not all supernova produce the same elements. It's the supernova that make the elements heavier than iron. But you don't get all the elements we see in the periodic table from just one supernova. And so here's the situation for our solar system. It must form next to at least three different kinds of supernova eruptions where the stars explode sufficiently far away from the solar system that they don't destroy the solar system, but close enough to the solar system where we get super enriched with all these elements heavier than iron, and also close enough that the aluminum 26 that's created and iron 60 that's made by these supernova eruptions blasts away all the light gases and reduces the quantity of water here on planet Earth. And there's something we're now discovering. We're finding planets that are like planet Earth in terms of their mass and their distance from their stars. But they're coming in with about 2,400 times as much nitrogen and 1,200 times as much carbon. And hence, you get very thick atmospheres and also very deep oceans. And for advanced life to be possible, you don't want that much carbon, nitrogen, or water. You've got to get rid of a lot of it. Well, our solar system had the benefit of being blasted by all this aluminum 26 and iron 60. These are radioactive short-lived elements, which basically blew away the light stuff and let our planet keep the heavy stuff. And it's short-lived, so that only lasts for about 500,000 to a couple of million years. And so once that's gone, you don't have to worry about the rest of the stuff disappearing. We get a short blast. And then what happens to our solar system is that it receives a gravitational kickout. You say, what is that? Well, we just had the good fortune of coming into contact with a couple of really big stars that gravitationally interact with our sun and caused our sun to be strongly ejected from the birthing cluster. That's crucial, because if you stay in that cluster, then the nearby stars are going to disrupt the planetary orbits. So it's important that while the planets are just beginning to form, we get powerfully kicked out. And also, you want to be kicked out to what's called the co-rotation distance in the center of our galaxy. That's the safest spot for advanced life. This is where it's about halfway out from the center of our galaxy. And by the way, to get the right birthing circumstances, we have to be born fairly near the center of our galaxy, where we get this enrichment, then get kicked out to the safe zone. The safe zone is that place where the spiral arms rotate at the same rate that stars revolve around the center of the galaxy. Now, if we're exactly at the co-rotation distance, then you're going to get what are called mean motion resonances, which are going to mess up the planetary orbits. So what you want to do is be just inside the co-rotation distance. And if you're just inside, you're only going to cross a spiral arm about once every billion years. And the last time we crossed was just before the Cambrian explosion. And right now we're in between two spiral arms. We're in the safest possible time in terms of having advanced life. 600 million years ago, the environment wasn't very nice in terms of our galaxy. But hey, now we're in that sweet spot of being halfway between the Perseus and the Sagittarius spiral arms. Now, I didn't mean to divert this far, but let me get back here. All right. Okay, thank you. This is one reason why you must have a universe with precisely the mass that we see in the universe. You want the universe to have just the right mass so that you're going to get these mix of elements and get that birthing situation. Let me just kind of finish that. Okay, you need to be kicked out, but you know, having been birthed in a cluster where you get blasted by the supernova and get super enriched by these heavy elements, it still will not give Earth the quantity of uranium and thorium it needs. You need two more episodes. So what happens is once we get into the safe zone, we have the moon-forming event. So now the solar system's in the safe zone, just inside the co-rotation distance of our spiral galaxy. And we've been there for the last 4.5 billion years. But now that you're in the safe zone, what takes place is the moon-forming event. You say, what's that? Well, at that time, there were two planets sharing the orbit of planet Earth. We had Earth and another planet that they've now called Theia. And what happened with Theia was about twice the mass of Mars, and was at what we physicists call the Lagrange point in the orbit of planet Earth. Those of you that have taken classical mechanics will realize that the famous physicist Lagrange calculated stable orbit positions. And it's actually possible for a planet that's orbiting a star that you're going to have another planet sharing the same orbit that will be stable, providing it's 60 degrees back along the orbit or 60 degrees forward along the orbit. And if you want to see a demonstration of this today, look at the asteroid belt, the main asteroid belt that accompanies Mars. Jupiter. So you got Jupiter orbiting our Sun, and 60 degrees forward in its orbit and 60 degrees back are two families of asteroids. They're called the Trojan asteroids.
The Van Allen belt?
No, that's not the Van Allen belt. it's the main asteroid belt. So that's an example of these asteroids that are, quote, in that stable zone. And so, yes, there was a planet that was at that zone. Now, those of you who have taken classical mechanics will realize it's stable for billions of years if you have three bodies. If you've got a star and the two planets sharing the same orbit, it's stable in a three-body situation. But it's not stable in a multiple-body situation. And so in our solar system, we got Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. And especially Jupiter and Saturn would operate through their gravity to disturb the smaller of the two planets more strongly than the bigger of the two planets. And so what happens is the smaller of the two planets gets jiggled a little bit away from its stable Lagrange point. And if it gets to be like, say, 59 degrees or 58 degrees instead of 60 degrees, then what happens is you get a slow creep of that smaller planet heading towards the bigger planet. And so what happened is this smaller planet, twice the mass of Mars, one quarter the mass of the Earth, slowly collided into planet Earth at a time when Earth had a really deep ocean. And if the ocean wasn't deep, the Earth would have been destroyed. But if you got a nice deep ocean, and hey, we know that, as I said, we're finding planets like the Earth with 500 to 1,000 times as much water as the Earth. And so it's quite reasonable, even with all that aluminum-26 and iron-60, that Earth would have had an ocean at least a few dozen times deeper than it has today. And with this planet colliding into that water at a low velocity, it turns the water into steam and causes almost all the water of planet Earth to leave, almost all the atmosphere of planet Earth to leave. Genesis 1:3, let there be light. There was a time when our atmosphere was 3 to 4 times thicker than Venus. And with an atmosphere that thick, light does not get through. And it's a standard principle. The more massive the planet, the farther away it is from its star, the thicker the atmosphere you'll have. So Earth one time had a very thick atmosphere that wouldn't let light pass through. But when this planet collided, that transformed our atmosphere from thick to thin. So that's why we have such a thin atmosphere in spite of the mass of our planet, and why we have such a thin layer of water on our planet instead of the thick layer that we would expect. But the other thing that happened is in the collision event, all the heavy element material in the collider kind of sunk into the core of the Earth. And all the light stuff in both planet Earth and the collider got ejected to outer space, and that formed the moon. It explains why the moon has a lighter composition than the Earth, because it formed as a result of the light material from the collision event being ejected into outer space. By the way, you can go to the NASA website and they'll show you a little animation DVD that shows you how astronomers have calculated what that collision would look like. And it's such that we even know the rotation rates of the two planets at the time before the collision and what happens to them afterwards. If you want to read up on this, there's an astronomer by the name of Robin Canoop, and she has spent the last 15 years working out the details of exactly how the moon formed. But the bottom line is that explains why we have so much more uranium and thorium than the other solar system planets. And by the way, there's a third enrichment that takes place, the late heavy bombardment. When Jupiter and Saturn disturb the Kuiper belt of asteroids and cause a massive rush of these asteroids into the inner solar system, and that wound up chemically transforming both the crust of the Earth and the interior of the Earth. Hey, if you want to read up about this, I've got six articles on our reasons.org website called The Turbulent Youth of the Solar System, where we talk about how our planet wound up with such an anomalous periodic table compared to all the other planets we see in the solar system.
What planets are close to the Van Allen Belt?
The Van Allen Belt refers to electromagnetic belts that are just around the Earth. Also, what it does is protect the Earth from getting hit by too much solar and cosmic radiation. So, hey, if you live in Alaska, you're going to get exposed a little bit more than if you live here in the Los Angeles area. Actually makes a difference of about 2 weeks on your expected lifespan.
Wow.
So, all right, but people in Alaska say they don't have as much stress as we do, so they're going to outlive us as a result of that. Okay. But a second reason why, and this turns out to require far more fine-tuning as to why you want the mass of the universe to be exactly what it is, where every star counts, every little particle of a rock or dust counts in order to make life possible here on planet Earth, is that the mass of the universe plays a crucial role in determining how fast the universe will expand. Now, I say a role. When I was taking astrophysics as a graduate student, the presumption back then was that mass was the sole factor governing the expansion of the universe. We now recognize there are two factors that govern the expansion of the universe from the cosmic creation event. I say that because the cosmic creation event had the universe immediately in an expanding state, but regulating that expansion is gravity, which tends to slow it down, and dark energy, which tends to speed it up. But the way gravity works is that the slowing down effect is going to depend on how close together the bits and pieces of matter are. And so I think you can kind of visualize that when the universe is young, the universe is going to be a lot smaller than it is today because the universe is continually expanding. And with a smaller universe, the bits and pieces of mass are going to be closer together. And being closer together, gravity is going to be more powerful in slowing down the expansion universe. You all heard that in your junior high physics class, right? Two massive bodies, and the closer they are together, the more powerfully they attract. So if you got all the bits and pieces of matter close together in the early universe, gravity will operate as a brake to slow down the cosmic expansion. Now, as the universe expands, these bits and pieces of matter will get farther and farther apart. And as you can see here in this slide, 12 billion years ago, the galaxies were jammed much more tightly together than they were just 2 billion years ago. Well, with the bits and pieces of matter expanding away from one another, gravity becomes progressively weaker and weaker in its capacity to slow down the expansion of the universe. Now, again, when I was a student, we were taught that that was the only factor that was governing the expansion of the universe. And I remember being taught, well, there's a problem if you expand the universe too quickly from the cosmic creation event. If you expand it too quickly, gravity will not have the power to collect gas into small enough condensed balls where you're going to get stars forming. And if you have a universe where stars never form, that is a universe that's forever nothing but dispersed gas, then you're never going to have stars, you're not going to have planets, you're not going to have any possibility for life. Life can't exist in a universe that's forever dispersed gas. But the other problem is if you expand the universe too slowly from the cosmic creation event, now you've got the bits and pieces of matter remaining close enough together that when stars form, they will form with such efficiency that all the stars will be really big. And the bigger the star, the faster it burns up, the more efficiently it burns up. And the problem with stars that end up their burning cycle where they're more massive than 140% of the mass of our star, the Sun, is that they're going to end up either as black holes or neutron stars. So if the mass of the universe is too great, stars will form, but they'll quickly all become nothing but neutron stars and black holes. Now, the minimum density in a neutron star is 2 billion tons per level teaspoonful. Okay, and in a black hole, the density is much, much higher. So the best you're going to see is a density of 2 billion tons per level teaspoonful. Can you imagine mixing that into a little cup of coffee, throwing it in there, 2 billion tons, okay? The density is so extreme that molecules are impossible. Atoms are impossible. In fact, we call them neutron stars because the density is so extreme that the electrons and the protons get fused together to make neutrons. So in a neutron star, there are no protons. There are no electrons. Basically, what a neutron star is, neutrons touching one another from the surface all the way to the core. And you get that extreme density. And you say, what's it like in a black hole? The density is so extreme where even the neutrons get broken up. And the density keeps going down where it gets denser and denser. Nothing stops it until the black hole shrinks to such a size. That's what a black hole does. It's shrinking under its own gravity, getting smaller and smaller as time goes by. However, Stephen Hawking pointed out some 30 years ago, there's a limit to how small you can make a black hole. Eventually, it gets about the size of a proton or an electron, and at that point, quantum mechanics becomes a sufficiently potent influence that everything that got sucked into the black hole winds up quantum tunneling out. And so black holes inevitably become white holes. And a white hole event is where the black hole shrinks down to such a tiny size that quantum mechanics causes everything inside to be blasted out. You know, I've got an astrophysics colleague at Reasons to Believe. He's got a sign on his door. What happens in a black hole stays in a black hole. So I went to him and said, you need to correct that. What happens in a black hole stays in a black hole for at least 10 to the 66 years. And that's one reason why we know the universe isn't super old. We don't see any white holes. The universe is not old enough for any of these black holes to have reached the size of quantum dimensions and become white holes. Yes?
Yeah. It always seems to me when you explain this, it's a very great explanation, by the way, but it always seems to me that, you know, 12 billion years and omnipotence and all the power in the world, and all you can do is bring us down to, you know, now. And all the—it just seems too many little tiny details that God has to attend to bring us here. I mean, it just doesn't work. And what happens when gravity expands so much that everything becomes dark? What's he going to do with our dark universe? Is he going to put that to use or?
Well, you're raising a good question, and we've been encouraging you to read the book Why the Universe is the Way It Is, because it answers all those questions. So, and...
I have, but I mean, you know...
Well, if you recall from the book, Al, we make the point that, yes, of course, God could have done it much more rapidly than 13.8 billion years. He's got lots of options. The reason why he chose to take the 13.8 billion years to get everything set is that he had a purpose for the different laws of physics. Remember, we just read that verse out of Romans 8, the entire creation is subject to the law of decay. Well, it's that law of decay that mandates that you need that 13.8 billion years to get everything prepared for human beings. Now, if you don't want that law of decay, then you can do it much faster. Well, you could. But see, these laws have a much higher purpose than simply preparing a home for human beings. Well, that's the whole point of the book, is that, you know, God had multiple reasons for setting up those laws of physics. And the most significant of those reasons is to put human beings on a planet where they can retain their free will, in fact, have their free will actually delivered where it could be far more expressive than it is today, given the laws of physics, but at the same time bring about the end of all evil and suffering. And for that to be possible, you need gravity, you need electromagnetism, You need the strong and weak nuclear force, and you need the second law of thermodynamics. Now, there's a chapter in the book that explains why all that is crucial. If your goal, if God's goal, is to eliminate evil and suffering without damaging or diminishing the free will of human beings.
We can't do that, eliminate evil and suffering, with the kind of cycles that we have of being born, being living, and dying. You can't eliminate that. I mean, even if you're God. I mean, this is our human.
Well, as the Bible explains, it can't be done by a single human being. In fact, if you go to Genesis 3, it makes the point it can't be done by men alone. It can't be done by females alone. You need both human males and human females to bring this about. So, you know, when we look at the men and women around the room here, recognize that both are critically needed if we're going to see the end of all evil and suffering. And it can't be done in one human lifespan. But the amazing thing is, it can be done in a few thousand generations of humanity. Okay? And see, we don't have to worry about the heat death of the universe. If God's going to bring about the end of all evil and suffering in a relatively brief period of time, then we can look forward to a new creation where we got completely different laws of physics. Yeah, go ahead.
I would point out that evil and suffering has been brought to an end by a single human being, Jesus.
Yes.
I think what you're referring to is that there's the necessity of the messianic line through the male and female to bring about Jesus. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. And you know, go back to the book of Romans, because you know the verse we put up here, we left off a verse. And so 23rd verse, and can I repeat what he was saying?
Yeah.
Well, his point was, hasn't Jesus on the cross already eliminated evil and suffering?
Yes.
That act on the cross brought about the end of all evil and suffering, and in the sense that what he did on the cross completed everything that was necessary. But notice we still have evil and suffering. It's not gone yet. And so there's a process by the work of the Holy Spirit whereby the work of Christ on the cross can work within people to transform them, to bring them. That's kind of what you see in Romans 8:23. Romans 8:20-22, the entire creation is subject to the law of decay, verse 23, until the fullness of the number of human beings who choose to be transformed by the Holy Spirit has been reached. And so the full number yet has not been reached, which is why we still have evil and suffering here. But when that happens, what does the text say? The law of decay will end. And so the law of decay is not the eternity that Lawrence Krauss speaks about or Stephen Hawking speaks about. And so, I mean, if I was an atheist, I'd be incredibly depressed. Because after all, what's the point of eating your dinner? What's the point of going to college if indeed the ultimate fate of all humanity is to disappear in a heat death? I don't know how many of you ever saw those movies put out by Woody Allen. But he actually produced a couple of movies where the theme was the heat death of the universe. And I forget this one movie, but it was this little boy doing his homework. He was like 10 or 11 years of age. And he complained to his parents, why should I do this homework and hand it in? What possible ultimate purpose does it have? Because after all, the heat death of the universe is coming. And so he refused to do his homework. Now, in one sense, he's philosophically on target. If the universe is all there is or was or ever will be, to quote a professor I had at the University of Toronto, Carl Sagan, yes. then there is no purpose, there is no meaning, there is no destiny for human beings, because there's going to come a time when the temperature of the universe will be the same everywhere. There'll be no possibility of heat flow from hot bodies to cold bodies, because the universe is getting colder and colder as it gets older and older. That inevitably will happen. The stars will burn out. And when that happens, there will no longer be a sufficiently efficient flow of energy to make metabolism possible. And when that happens, life everywhere in the universe dies. And as Lawrence Krauss pointed out in a paper he published in the Astrophysical Journal a few years ago, with the end of all life is the end of all consciousness, and with the end of all consciousness is the end of all meaning and purpose and destiny for all life everywhere in the universe. most depressing paper I ever read in the scientific literature, but it's making a key point. If the universe is all there is or was or ever will be, then everything is meaningless. Now, Solomon dealt with that in Ecclesiastes. He said, everything is meaningless unless, chapter 12, God is there to take our situation and transform us and replace this universe with a brand new creation. So I would argue, and this is the theme of why the universe is the way it is, God gave us these laws of physics in order that God, through us and through the work of Christ on the cross, could bring about the end of all evil and suffering. And when that happens, the universe will have fulfilled its ultimate purpose and destiny. God no longer has a need for that. In fact, we're going to be addressing that in Psalm 147 and 148. There are texts in these creation psalms that make it clear this universe of stars and galaxies and planets is temporary. It exists only up until the time that Christ's purpose for creating the universe has been fulfilled and the full number of human beings will receive salvation has been reached. And then at that point, God will replace his universe with a brand new realm. As he spoke it into existence, he'll speak it out of existence. Now, what I find fascinating is that scriptures are clear that the universe began in a space-time singularity. There are three passages in the Bible that tell us it will end in a space-time singularity. God's going to roll up the heavens like a scroll and it'll disappear in a fiery heat. Now, there's a variety of ways I can conceive of as an astrophysicist how that could happen. We've described some here in the class. So the universe could possibly end that way. That would be the end of the universe, but that won't happen until God conquers evil. Okay, go ahead.
I was just going to ask about that. Do you feel that in Revelation when it says the stars fell from the sky like ripe figs, and again in Epistles of Peter when he says, you know, the elements will be destroyed by fire, do you see that as consistent with the big crunch as observed from Earth? You're watching the stars streak across the sky as you go towards the sky.
Okay, I personally think that's referring to two different things. Because so in the book of Revelation, it talks about the stars falling from the sky. That could easily be some comet breaking up and, you know, just getting all kinds of shooting stars coming down here. It's in the same context where it talks about an asteroid striking the Earth and poisoning one-third of the world's fresh water. It talks about the light of the sun, moon, and stars dimming by a third. That, to me, sounds like dust in the atmosphere. Also says that the light of the sun, moon, and stars will turn red like the blood of a corpse. Well, those of us who lived here in Southern California, we've seen what forest fires do. It turns the light of the sun, moon, and stars into blood, like the blood of a corpse. And so I think it's referring to what's going to be in the atmosphere and what's falling from outer space into the atmosphere of the Earth. But what we see there in 2 Peter 3, I think, is a reference to the end of the universe. And you'll see it in Isaiah, Revelation, and 2 Peter. And all three of them basically say the same thing. God's going to roll up the heavens like a scroll, and it's going to disappear in a fiery heat. Now, that could be a singularity end to the universe. It would certainly be consistent with it. But a number of Hebrew and Greek scholars have pointed out there's other ways to interpret that. And after all, it's only one sentence repeated three times by three different authors. So you don't have a lot of detail as to what the scriptures are trying to communicate. But if you do take it literally, it would be the universe being rolled up and ending in a singularity. Would that necessarily be a big crunch? It could, but a lot of the data tells us the universe can't end that way. Now that we know that the universe is dominated by dark energy, there's nothing to stop the expansion. It's going to continue to expand. In fact, it'll expand at a faster and faster rate. In fact, we're living in a time when the far edges of the space surface of the universe are moving away from us at barely under the velocity of light. There's going to come a time when it'll move faster than the velocity of light, and then it keeps going to go faster and faster as time goes on. So in that sense, the big crunch model of the 70s and 80s is no longer viable. However, there are other ways you can make it work. And one example, I think I talked about this 2 weeks ago, as a matter of fact.
Is that in the book in a particular place?
Yeah, I think in The Creator and the Cosmos, I talk about one of the models that would actually be consistent with a literal reading of those texts. It's called the ekpyrotic Big Bang model. And the ekpyrotic Big Bang model basically says we already know that the universe has a flat geometry. And we already know it's nine dimensions of space and one dimension of time. Now, this is a crude picture, because what I'm going to show you has two dimensions. So here we got a sheet of paper here, which is two dimensions. And so we're looking at flat two dimensions, all right? The real universe has 10 dimensions, not two. And you can't visualize what the 10 dimensions look like, but we'll just use this for illustration. Here's this flat sheet. We already know that the universe we observe is not as big as the universe of today, because after all, within a continuous expanding universe, the universe of today is bigger than the universe we see through the telescopes. And so there are those who speculate that this is a flat sheet everywhere we see, but way beyond where we can't see, there is a possibility that the flat sheet curls in on itself like this. And so here we are on the bottom part of the sheet, and everywhere we look, it's flat. We can't see far enough to see the curvature where it turns in on itself. But what you would really have is a picture of the universe where we're here, for example, on this flat sheet, but if we look up, there's another flat sheet that's actually part of the same flat sheet. Now, when I say look up, you're not going to be able to look up. You can only look along the surface. But the truth is, you'd have a 10-dimensional flat sheet facing another 10-dimensional flat sheet. Now, what astronomers have calculated is the distance that these sheets have to be away from one another such that it would be possible that a quantum space-time fluctuation in the top sheet could make contact with a quantum space-time fluctuation on the bottom sheet. If they make contact, the entire space-time realm disappears into a singularity, and that's the end of the universe. So, that sounds pretty close to what 2 Peter 3 is talking about. But again, I want to remind you, I do know Bible scholars who look at those passages as metaphors rather than as a literal description of how the universe will end in a singularity event. But it is intriguing that if it is meant to be taken literally, there are actually viable models of the universe that predict that. Now, if you want to know how close the two sheets have to be to one another, and, the closer they are, the faster it's going to happen. The more distant they are, the longer it's going to take. If you want to have, say, a 50-50 chance of that happening within 20 billion years, the two sheets have to be about a millimeter apart. And so, if they're about a millimeter apart, tomorrow it could happen, all right? Or next year it could happen. Universe is, 13.8 billion years old, so if they're a millimeter apart, we're all set for the end. Okay.
Well, we're Mr. and Mrs. Platt, so we can't tell.
Yeah. I mean, there's no way to make measurements to prove that this is indeed a correct model of the universe. It's a possible model of the universe. It doesn't violate any observations. But yet people have been critical of it in the scientific literature by saying it can't be tested. We can't test the difference between an ekpyrotic model of the universe and one where it's a 10-dimensional sheet that just extends out to the full extent of the universe. We won't know. However, if it happens, then we'll know. In the back.
We just hear Peruni that time.
You were saying that people would say if you die, you live and you die, and that's it. There's no meaning, like Woody Allen as a kid saying, "Why do I do my homework? I'm going to die. The universe is going to end. What's the meaning of life?" So, I guess, are you implying that the meaning of life means it has to be eternal? I mean, it's like going on a roller coaster ride. It's not going to end forever. It's not going to go on forever. You enjoy it while it's there. So, could not the meaning of life be that you enjoy it while you have it? You have the memories, you die, and that's it? Or does there have to be an eternity
Well,
for there to be meaning.
No, I've debated atheists who make that point. They say, you know, the meaning of life is the few decades we have here on Earth.
Even that has no meaning.
Well, that's the whole point. If indeed Carl Sagan is right and Lawrence Krauss is right, then these few decades, it doesn't matter how we live. And that's the point they make in their scientific articles. You may as well be a rock for all the difference it's going to make in the ultimate destiny of all things. Because what's going to happen after you die is no different than what happens if you're just a plain old rock or a piece of speck in the universe. And the point that you know, Carl Sagan would make is we have no greater value than a speck of dust. No greater purpose. Well, his point was that the universe indeed is all there is or ever was or ever will be. And he believed that, at least up until the last couple of years of his life. Then indeed, there is no greater benefit to being a human being than being a rock. Or being a worm.
Yeah, but wait, one second. If you spend your whole life in the closet, just don't even go out, or you spend your life being very productive and informing people and reaching people and loving people and having a prosperous life, I mean, there's a difference there. So wouldn't that give meaning to life, the one that you're living up to your potential as much as you can, as opposed to just, you know, lying in bed and being a slovenly pig? But
you
see what I'm saying? I mean,
yeah, but you
know,
Woody Allen's point was if the universe is all there is or was or ever will be, there is no difference between spending all your time sitting in bed and doing nothing and living a very productive life. Because what's going to happen to everything you produce? Everything you produce is going to disappear. None of it's going to last.
He's a professional pessimist. He doesn't enjoy. There's a term for him. I've met him actually once, and he said that he doesn't enjoy things. He's always looking ahead. But you know, there was one incredible thing. He was, you know, taking a metaphysical exam, and he was caught cheating on his metaphysical exam. He was caught peering into the soul of the guy next to him.
Woody Allen backwards. Well, some of you know of Richard Feynman, and his whole point was, you know, because he was an atheist, he had a number of Christian students throughout his year and very much admired them, but his point was the purpose and meaning of life is those few seconds when you make a eureka discovery. So his whole point is, yeah, you live 70 years, but it all boils down into maybe 5 seconds where you get this emotional high from making a particular discovery. And my response is, well, what if you're not a scientist? And what if you never had those 5 seconds? Then what? So, but the whole point is, even those 5 seconds have no ultimate purpose or meaning. And the point is, none of us believes that. I mean, you know, many of you were with me at the Skeptics conference where they devoted a whole weekend to trying to prove from science that there is no God. But what I noticed about their lectures, every one of them was refusing to abandon the idea that we have ultimate purpose and destiny. And there's a reason why. Ecclesiastes 3:11, God has written eternity in the heart of every human being. There's something deep within us that recognizes, hey, we do have ultimate purpose and destiny. This life isn't all there is. Which is why we respond to death so differently than the animals. Because unlike the animals, we don't just simply go to the dust. We continue to live beyond this life we spend here on earth. And all of us ultimately know that because it says God wrote that on our hearts. Just like He wrote the law on our hearts, the moral law, He's also written on our hearts that we have this destiny and this purpose, which explains why even atheists can't go along with Woody Allen and with Carl Sagan, with rare exception. In fact, when I had Carl as a professor, it seemed to me he believed in purpose and destiny, just the way he was lecturing, the way he lived, but it was inconsistent with his philosophy. So there's something within us that just wrestles with that idea that we're no better than an ant or a rock. We all know we are. Well, what does that mean? Yeah, go ahead, Al.
Yeah, if I was a professor I would say, look, we're all born agnostic, aren't we? I mean, we have nothing in our brain.
No.
I mean, really? What have we got in our brain? Where do we get with our beliefs? As soon as we come out and we get slapped on the butt, our brain is awakened. Okay? From then on, our brain begins
I can tell you're a man. You know, you ladies in here who have had children, you know that the mind is operating even when that child is in the womb.
Okay, but it's a constant. I mean, it's a blank slate, usually.
No.
What is
hey.
He doesn't come out, you know, writing formulas. Right?
I saw what David and Joel were doing long before they came out of the womb. I could tell that their minds were active.
You saw that?
Oh yeah.
And you believe? And you didn't forget that?
Well, I mean, I kind of knew the personality of both of my sons before they were born, just by the way they were behaving in the womb.
That's great. That's
so, I mean, I was listening to their heartbeat. I was checking their activity. I'm a scientist. I was doing all these experiments. So,
my point is that we're born into a box, okay? We're born into a family. Now, whatever that family, that mother and father, believe, that's what you're going to believe. And they put the notion of God or spirituality in your head while you're raised.
Hal, I'm a living testimony. That's not true.
I'm a living testimony.
I mean, look at all these boxes there. You can be a Muslim. You can be a Jew.
Well, let's do a quick survey here. How many of here in the room wound up believing by the time they were in their late teens or earlier something radically different than what your parents believed? Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
That's more than half.
Yeah, but I think most it's very hard to change the beliefs of somebody that.
Well, half of us disagree, Al.
The second thing that dispersed that is that scientists really amazed as the explorers, especially from England, went out into Africa, Australia, and everything. They kept thinking that they would find some religious free community, some isolated community that had been there for 10,000 years. And that wasn't the case. And no matter what little tribe you found living in what little part of the world, they had spiritual worship. You know, and obviously that's obviously where this Bible verse then came back to mind, that we are created spirit beings, and no matter what culture, no matter how isolated, for how many thousands of years, there was spiritual worship there. There is no community that was without it. And of course, the few people that tried it, like the Soviet Union and China, it was a dismal failure to try and make an atheist community because the people weren't built that way. I mean, trying to train them from education doesn't go that way. I spent 3 weeks in the Soviet Union, and the people there knew that the government was stupid, you know, to try to say there was no God, you know. It's so obvious, you know. And that's why they obviously voted themselves out of existence, because they realized their government system was totally flawed to say there was no God.
We got just a few minutes.
No more questions.
Okay.
Is we're going to give you 3 minutes.
Yeah, let me see if I can wrap this up. That'd be great. And I'm not going to get to my scientific discovery. We're going to have to save that for next week.
Oh,
well,
give us a teaser.
I'll give you a teaser.
All right.
For the first time, physicists and astronomers have been able to test the spatial constancy of the laws of physics. That's all because of the Planck satellite. We've been able to do that. For the first time, we can look at the entire scope of the universe and realize the laws of physics are the same everywhere we look. We've been able to do that temporally by kind of looking at distant galaxies and saying in the past the laws of physics are the same as they are here. But until a week ago, we've not had the ability to be able to look at the universe as a whole and test the spatial. And see, that's the heart of Romans 1, or Romans 8. The entire creation, the entire universe, is subject to the law of decay. Now, we've been able to test that by looking at the past history of the universe. But for the first time, we can look at one epoch of the universe and see if it's the same everywhere we look. And it's because of some amazing technology that we're able to do that, and some sophisticated physics. That'll happen next week. Let me wrap up this thing about the expansion. Okay. Before we got diverted, I mentioned how the mass of the universe determines how fast the universe expands, because if you got more mass, it's slower. If you got less mass, it's faster. dark energy works the opposite way. Okay, dark energy is such that it's energy embedded in the space surface of the universe that causes the universe to expand at a faster rate, and it's in proportion to the size of the surface. So when the universe is small, dark energy will be weak in its capacity to accelerate cosmic expansion. But as the universe expands, the surface gets bigger. And as the surface gets bigger, dark energy becomes more and more powerful in its ability to accelerate the expansion of the universe. It's just the opposite of gravity. Gravity is most potent when the universe is young, and not very potent at all when the universe gets old and big. Dark energy is weak when the universe is young, but very powerful when the universe is old and big. And it's such that measurements now tell us that for the first 7 billion years of cosmic history, the expansion of the universe was slowing down. But the slowing down effect was getting weaker and weaker as the universe got older and older. And about 7 billion years ago, dark energy became more dominant than the gravity effect. So for the last 7 billion years, the universe has been expanding at a faster and faster rate, which is why we know that there isn't going to be this rebound where the universe collapses. Dark energy from now on will always be stronger than the gravity effect, and it gets stronger and stronger with every year that goes by. So next year, the universe will expand faster than it's expanding right now, and that will continue. However, it was an atheist physicist by the name of Robert Dicke that pointed out in the early 1960s that the expansion of the universe must be exquisitely fine-tuned. In fact, at the time, it was the greatest evidence for fine-tuning that we knew of. Namely, that if you expand the universe too quickly from the cosmic creation event, stars won't form. If you expand it too slowly, all you get are black holes and neutron stars. I've already explained that. But what Robert Dicke pointed out is that the expansion rate of the universe has to be tuned to within 1 part in 10 to the 56th power in order to get a universe with stars, galaxies, and planets. Now, that was back in the 1960s. What has happened since is we realize, okay, that's just to get stars. If you want the kind of stars that makes life possible, existing at the right time and the right place in the history and geography of the universe, where those stars can also produce the kinds of planets that are necessary to make life possible, the fine-tuning is much greater. In fact, we now understand it's crucial that the universe be slowing down on its cosmic expansion early in its history and speeding up in the latter part of its history in order to get the planets and stars showing up at the right time in the right place to make life possible. Now, in the absence of dark energy, it was determined that you would have to fine-tune the mass of the universe to better than 1 part in 10 to the 60th power. That means to better than 1 part in a quadrillion, 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 quadrillion. Now, if you actually work that out, that means if you were to add a dime's worth of mass to the universe or take away a dime's worth from the universe, that would disturb the balance. Now, a little qualifier there. It's not that delicate today. In other words, if you were to add a nickel to the total mass of the universe or take away a nickel, it won't make much difference. But when the universe is really young, adding a nickel or subtracting a nickel will disturb the balance. So it is really that sensitive. The mass of the universe must be incredibly fine-tuned to make it all happen. Now, what has happened with the discovery of dark energy, we realize that with dark energy, we don't need to fine-tune the mass of the universe quite to that degree. And so we can reduce that 1 part in 10 to the 60th. However, there's a consequence. It means that the fine-tuning in the dark energy must be better to 1 part in 10 to the 122nd power. And it really doesn't matter what the mass of the universe is, you're still stuck with that fine-tuning. 1 part in 10 to the 100, so that means that the dark energy must be fine-tuned by 100 quadrillion, 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 quadrillion times more than if you're trying to do everything with just the mass. And those two factors, rank as the most spectacular evidence for fine-tuning design that's known within all the sciences. So if you're asking me the question, where do we find the best known evidence for supernatural, superintelligent design? It would be the dark energy and the mass of the universe. So when it tells us that God knows the name of every star, literally every star counts. Every little bit of matter counts. Without it, we wouldn't be here. So come November, when you celebrate Thanksgiving, you might want to thank God for all those little stars that are out there. And the fact that God knows every star by name means there's a good chance He knows what your name is. Because after all, a star is nothing but a big ball of gas. And as I said 2 weeks ago, every one of you is much more important than a big ball of gas. So God knows your name, and you're far more important. God created all those big balls of gas so that you could exist. Anyway, let me close. Father in heaven, we want to thank you that today we live in the 21st century where we can see the evidence for your handiwork in designing, creating, and fine-tuning everything for a specific benefit. It's just so evident. And Father, I pray that you would enable those of us here to be able to share this information with people that don't yet know you as Lord and Savior, that they may recognize that you truly do exist. Lord, I pray too that they would also recognize that you not only exist, but that you are a rewarder of those that diligently seek you. So Father, I pray that you'd motivate each one of us to continue seeking the evidence for your handiwork, the evidence for your care for us, and your desire to reward us, not only in this creation, but the creation to come. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.